The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Our alarm went off and we had to leave the dinner at the table and evacuate the building as the rules are. But luckily, the Rose Tattoo was quite accommodating, and we had dinner there, but it took us, you know, we couldn't quite get back in time for 8 o'clock. I'm Elliot Shalcrott, the president of the library, and I'm delighted that you're here this evening. We're going to have a very, very interesting evening with our special guest, Ross King. Please turn off your cell phones, matter of fact, better do it myself. And as you know, we'll have an opportunity to meet Mr. King upstairs. And if you haven't already purchased a book, get a book and get it signed. There we go. Anyone familiar with Mr. King's writing knows that he has an astounding knowledge of European cultural history. Born and raised in Canada, earned his PhD in English literature, moved to England where he has lived since 1992, and assumed a research position at the University of London. He is absolutely, the best-selling author of art history books. Ross King excels in very vivid portrayals of the Renaissance period, with its half-mad and also gifted artists, with political intrigues, technical advances, corrupt popes, and sexual libertines. He is the author of Brunelleschi's Dome, Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, and the novels Ex Libris and Domino. King's very highly acclaimed book, Brunelleschi's Dome, was an instant hit in the United States, and landing on the New York Times, Boston Globe, and San Francisco Chronicle bestseller lists. His next book, Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, was a finalist at the National Book Critics Circle and award in 03, and is again an extraordinarily readable account of the 4 years Michelangelo spent painting that marvelous ceiling. And it's all set up against the upheaval of early 16th century Rome. In The Judgment of Paris, his third engaging and illuminating inquiry, the rise of Edouard Manet and the fall of Ernest Meissonier provide the narrative spine for what one reviewer called a clash of ideas more exciting than the clanging of swords. So please join me in welcoming to the Free Library, Ross King.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So great pleasure to be back in Philadelphia and at the Free Library. What I want to do tonight is talk for a little bit about these two characters I have in my book. And I used them to set up what I think we can see as a kind of puzzle about Impressionism, something that I'm sure has occurred to anyone who knows anything about the history of it, and anyone who's been to one of the blockbuster exhibits on Impressionism in the late 20th century or early 21st century, i.e. this was one of the most reviled artistic movements in history at its inception in the 1860s, something I'll talk about a bit more in the next 40 minutes or so. At the same time, however, it's now become, in the 130, 140 years after that, it's become this incredibly popular phenomenon. It's one of the most endearing and enduring movements in the history of art. Just to give a couple of examples of the current popularity of Impressionism, some of you might be aware of how just last week in Las Vegas there closed a showing of Impressionist paintings at the Bellagio Hotel, the purpose-built art gallery in the Bellagio Hotel, an exhibition of paintings from the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And so we've reached the point in 2006 where the Impressionists are able to play Vegas and appear at the Bellagio Hotel with Celine Dion and other superstars such as that. And so what I wanted to do in the book, in a way, was to rewind through those decades and try to understand how the kind of art that we find, maybe even a bit overly prettified or innocuous, could have caused such offense in the middle of the 19th century. What sort of world did they inhabit in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s that made them see the paintings of these men and in some cases women so differently from how we see them today? What was art about in those days? What were people about? And as I say, in order to try to explain this phenomenon, I give a sort of tale of two painters, these two men who share, coincidentally, wonderful coincidence for me, nothing but a set of initials EM. On the one hand, Edouard Manet, on the other, Ernest Meissonier. They were described by many of their contemporaries as the two opposite poles of art. It was said that these were two men who could not live together. Essentially, Paris wasn't big enough for the both of them. If one was going to be popular, the other couldn't be. They were the two opposite poles. I want to introduce, bring out the red corner and the blue corner. Beginning with the elder of the two, Meissonier. He's not someone about whom we can say he needs no introduction. He assuredly does need an introduction. Many people have said to me after starting the book or after hearing about the book that they're embarrassed to tell me, or they don't want to tell me initially, that they haven't heard of Meissonier. And I tell them there's absolutely nothing to apologize for. For reasons that I'll discuss, there are any number of reasons why no one's heard of him today. To give a few biographical details about him, he was born in 1815, which was the year of Waterloo, which will become significant, as I'll describe in a couple of minutes. He was a very interesting character to study. He was someone that I loved writing about, loved researching into, if I wouldn't necessarily have wanted to have him around to my house for dinner. He was, in this picture, this photograph, which is by Nadar, one of the most famous photographers of the age, it's taken in about 1860. It, I think, captures his personality quite well. He was extremely arrogant, very pompous, ambitious, and in many ways extremely unpleasant. And he also had great delusions of grandeur and a sense of his own self-worth, which, as I'll describe, was in some ways quite justified. There are legends, all sorts of legends about Meissonier. He was a larger-than-life character. He knew virtually everyone who was anyone at that time, and they all left stories behind about him because he was such a character. One of my favorites, and something that I think gives us an indication of what exactly his character was like, concerns him at the end of his life when he was going to be rewarded. I mean, he won virtually every possible award you could win in France, both civic and artistic. He was going to be rewarded with one of the greatest, the Rue Meissonier, which was a street named after him that was going to be running through the center of Paris. When he learned about this street, he was furious, and his friends couldn't understand why, and they said, but this is a great honor to have the Rue Meissonier street named after you. And he said, I demand a boulevard. It was almost as if nothing less than a boulevard could be satisfactory for someone of his grandeur. I should specify his grandeur. He truly was, much as it is hard for us to believe today, but he truly was the most popular, acclaimed, and wealthy painter in France through the second half of the 19th century. From the time he began exhibiting his works in the late 1830s to the time that he really reached the height of his powers in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, until he died in 1891, he enjoyed what one critic wrote in Meissonier's obituary, the glory of five decades without eclipse. There are all sorts of stories of other painters endlessly deferring to him. For example, Eugène Delacroix, whom we now think of, the great romantic painter that we now think of, one of the titans of French art, said, "Amongst all of us, Meissonier is the one who will be remembered for certain." The most important art critic of the day, a man named Théophile Gautier, said that Meissonier was the one painter from the 19th century who was guaranteed to be consecrated in the museums of the future. The basis of this fame was perhaps somewhat puzzling to us. I'll show you a number of his paintings. I apologize for this one being in black and white. It's in Windsor Castle. It was painted in the early 1850s. It's called The Brawl, and is very typical of the sort of work that he did. It was shown at the Paris Exposition of 1855, where it was the most popular exhibit, and it shows exactly, as the title describes, a brawl fought between, or trying to be fought, between a couple of men inside a tavern. And it's very typical of the sort of work he did in that it's a scene from the past. It's a scene from the 17th century. Meissonier said, "The only purpose of art is to show people the past as it really was." And that's what he thought art was all about, to look at the past. And the critics of the day celebrated his work as what one of them, Gautier, called a complete resurrection of the life of bygone days. I'll give you a Meissonier in color. And this one was done a couple of years later, from 1858, and is once again very typical of his work. Once again, another resurrection of the life of bygone days. This man from probably the 18th century, wearing his silk stockings, knee breeches, his long coat, reading a book and standing in front of a tapestry, which just so happened to be a tapestry that Meissonier had in his house, because he didn't try, or rather, I should correct myself, in his mansion, because Meissonier didn't only try to recreate the past as it was in his painting, he tried to do it in his life as well. And so he lived in faux medieval splendor 12 miles outside of Paris, on the Seine at a place called Poissy. He occupied a converted nunnery, which he decorated with tapestries. He began painting his own frescoes onto the walls. And he had Louis XIV, Louis XV furniture. And so he really was a man at odds with the 19th century, because the great irony of Meissonier's work and his sort of philosophy and predilections was the fact that he was doing all of this at a time when France was moving rapidly forward. By the 1850s and 1860s, France was becoming industrialized somewhat belatedly compared to America and Britain, but also it was becoming very wealthy and prosperous. Meissonier didn't like any of this. Like, I think, a lot of people in France at the time, he looked back to what he believed was a simpler age, and therefore conjured up these nostalgic scenes, which obviously tapped a vein in the French public, and sort of made them nostalgic for a time before 1789, the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, and so forth. This sort of work that he did won him, as I've been implying, tremendous wealth and acclaim. Whenever one of his works went on show in Paris, usually in the annual Salon, enormous crowds gathered round to exclaim over the beauties of the latest Meissonier painting. And so trying to see one of his works in the Salon was rather like trying to see the Mona Lisa in the Louvre today, that you have to wait your turn at the back of a huge crush of people, gradually inch your way forward and have your 15 seconds or so in front of the work before you were able to before you were edged out of the way, elbowed out of the way by other people equally eager to see his work. His paintings were also popular with the collectors. He no one who had very deep pockets and a supposed love of art in those days could consider his private art gallery complete without at least a number of Meissonier paintings on the walls. And so people like James de Rothschild, the head of the banking family in France, William H. Vanderbilt in America, the Marquess of Hertford, the wealthiest painting collector of all from England. All of them collected Meissonier paintings. And the result of that, of course, was that the prices of his paintings were incredibly high. And in fact, one of them, this particular work, The Campaign of France, was the most expensive painting of the 19th century. It shattered the record. Meissonier finished it in 1863, and it was sold off his easel while the paint was still wet, which is the way his paintings always sold. But then almost 30 years later in 1890, the year before Meissonier died, it was sold again to a man named Alfred Chauchard, who was the founder of an enormous department store in Paris. He bought it for 850,000 francs, which was the highest price ever paid for a work of art, for a painting by an artist either living or dead. Just to give you an indication of the worth of 850,000 francs, the entire annual operating budget of the Paris Opera around the same time was 800,000 francs, and that had to manage to support 70 musicians, 60 dancers, 50 choristers, the entire bureaucracy, the upkeep of the building, etc., etc. So it was an enormous sum of money. And if I can just say a couple of things about this painting quickly, there's something else in. I'll show the sort of the Meissonier touches that made him so popular with the people in France at the time. This obviously is a Napoleonic scene. We have Napoleon Bonaparte on his white charger. This is sometimes erroneously called the retreat from Russia. It's not Napoleon retreating from Russia in 1812. It's Napoleon retreating back to Paris in 1814 after the Allied forces have defeated him. He's going to abdicate in favor of his son, and then the Hundred Days will follow. Meissonier was known as the greatest technician of the brush in the history of art. It was said that no one else could paint with such beautiful precision as he could. The other thing that he was known for was the immense labors he put into all of his works, not only with his brush, but also when he began a painting, which would often take any number of years, even though they were often only about 2 feet square. He did enormous researches into the subject. And so, for example, he always made certain that everything was historically accurate. The actual saddle that Napoleon rode on, he borrowed it from the museum in Paris in order to do it. He had Napoleon's famous greatcoat reproduced stitch by stitch, button by button. He had people, this is Marshal Ney, the man known as the bravest of the brave, the great Napoleonic general. He interviewed people who'd known the marshal to find out exactly how he rode his horse, et cetera, et cetera. All of these incredibly, almost anally retentive details, he was absolutely determined to have correct. And what's interesting about Meissonier is he staged tableaus of all of his paintings, and that held true for Napoleonic battle scenes that he painted. And so when he began work on this painting, he staged this scene in the grounds of his house at Poissy. And I think when you know about his personality, you aren't surprised to find out that Napoleon Bonaparte, the role of Napoleon was played by Meissonier himself. And he said, "I have exactly his thighs." And I'm not sure how he knew quite what Napoleon's thighs were like, but I think it's probably safe to say that he had world's first Napoleon complex and was absolutely determined to conquer Europe, conquer the world in the way that Napoleon was. This painting, the most expensive painting of the 19th century, was not, however, Meissonier's most famous work. That was this particular one, another Napoleonic battle scene called Friedland 1807. And it shows, if the campaign of France shows Napoleon at one of his lowest moments, this shows him at his greatest. He's on, again, Marengo, his white charger, raising his hat and taking a salute from the charging cavalry who have just, in June of 1807, at the Battle of Friedland, defeated the forces of the Tsar, and therefore they've marched all the way across Europe from Boulogne to East Prussia, defeating army after army. Napoleon has made himself master of the entire European continent. Meissonier finished this work in 1874. He sold it very soon afterwards to Alexander T. Stewart, a name that might be familiar to some of you. He was the third wealthiest man in America in the 1860s and 1870s, only behind the Astors and the Vanderbilts. Although he was... tomb in St. Mark's in the Bowery in South Manhattan and ransomed it. Stewart had paid 350,000 francs, then a record for this painting. He was ransomed for only $20,000, roughly a quarter. Are we okay?
Everything is fine.
Well, just pretend we didn't hear that. So in many ways, Stewart was worth less than the painting that was hanging in his gallery, and the thieves would have been better off to steal his painting and leave the body where it was. Anyway, all of this fame that I've been, and wealth, fame, acclaim that Meissonier enjoyed, begs the question of what exactly happened to him in the 20th century, and why have we not heard of him, and why is it very difficult to see any of his paintings, or as I discovered, very difficult to get reproductions, slides of his paintings. I'll just give a couple of examples of the fate of Meissonier in the 20th century and how he paid for this. I mean, it's almost as if he made a Faustian pact that for he paid for the enormous success and acclaim in his own lifetime with utter oblivion afterwards. It became possible by the 1940s for a man named Lionello Venturi, a very fine art historian, to write a two-volume history of French art, French 19th century art, without making a single reference to Meissonier's name, something that would have been unthinkable in the 1890s. I mean, people would have been shocked had they known that. Likewise, there's something even more chilling. In the 1960s, the government of Charles de Gaulle removed from the Louvre a statue of Meissonier that was carved in 1895, a couple of years after his death, and placed in the Louvre amongst a sort of pantheon of great painters. And de Gaulle's cultural czar, André Malraux, ordered it to be removed. So Meissonier was sort of toppled like a dictator, a fallen dictator, and removed feet first from the Louvre. And so he really was airbrushed out of the history of French art. This then begs the question of why was this happening? Why do the French in particular now conceive such a hatred of him after having worshipped him and having flaunted him in the face of the rest of the world as the greatest painter of the 19th century? Obviously, his opposite number, I think, has something to do with that, because the seeds of Meissonier's ruin didn't begin to sprout only in the 20th century when the prices of his paintings began to decline. They were growing in the 1860s when he was at the height of his power. This painting is very interesting for my purposes, because of the time it was painted. My book, The Judgment of Paris, is partly about the painting of this work. He began it in 1863, he finished it in 1874, and those, as you probably know, are key dates in the history of French art and the history of art more generally, 1863 being the year of the Salon de Refusés, which I'll come back to in a couple of minutes, 1874, the date of the what we now know as the first Impressionist exhibition. Therefore, as Meissonier was working on this painting, which he believed was going to be his magnum opus, a work that I should say now hangs in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and which you, unlike many of his paintings, you can see. While he was working on this, there was upheaval and turbulence in the world of French art, much of which he participated in. And that, of course, was led, this revolution in art was led by one man in particular, Edouard Manet. I'll just say a few things about him, because he, I think, needs less of an introduction. He was born in 1832, which made him 17 years younger than my Saunier, so he wasn't really the next generation of painter. He was a younger contemporary of him. He studied under a man named Thomas Couture, whose name isn't really that well known to us today, but he was a very famous teacher and painter in his own lifetime in the 1840s and 1850s. He was known, Couture, for painting scenes from ancient Greece and Rome. His most famous painting from the late 1840s, just before Manet went into his studio, was called The Romans of the Decadence, and it's very typical of what he did. There's all sorts of gratuitous nudity and swilling of wine and swirling of togas and crowning with laurel leaves and so forth. And that was very typical of the art of the 1830s, 1840s. However, despite the fact that this was a trademark of Couture, he didn't believe, like Meissonier, that the only thing that a painter was to do was to show people the past as it really was. He thought that painters, including his students, should take up their brushes and do scenes from modern life. And he, in particular, asked them to paint people enjoying themselves on public holidays and locomotives. And he said the only reason Raphael didn't paint locomotives is because they hadn't been invented in the 16th century, and otherwise he would have been. And by the 1850s, when Manet was a young art student, this belief in painting modern life was becoming more and more prevalent. A lot of critics were starting to find it somewhat odd that in an age of electricity and steam and telegraph and industry, painters were still rehashing and rehearsing scenes from ancient Greece and Rome, or trying to paint like Raphael, Michelangelo, Titian, and so forth. And so he, as I say, urged his students to paint otherwise. The most articulate spokesperson for this type of painting, the new art, was this man, Charles Baudelaire, who was the most notorious poet of the 1850s. Les Fleurs du Mal was 1857. In 1859 he wrote, and in 1863 he published, a work called The Painter of Modern Life, in which he urged artists to abandon what he called the dress of the past. I think he was probably making an allusion to people like Couture and Meissonier with that comment, and he wanted them to paint instead modern bourgeois costumes. He specifically asked for painters to work on things like top hats and frock coats. He said these are as relevant, or are much more relevant to us today than any of the scenes of the past. Not surprisingly, I think, given this philosophy, Baudelaire was not a particular fan of Meissonier. He was one of the few dissenting voices in the critical chorus of praise. You might know that Baudelaire did write a lot on art and actually had quite a good reputation as an art critic in the 1840s and 50s. He was, however, very good friends with Edouard Manet. Manet was somewhat younger than him, but the two of them became very good friends by at least the mid-1850s and hung out together in the cafes and on the boulevards. However, despite this friendship with Baudelaire, and despite the fact that he was a student of Couture, Manet, as a young art student, was an unlikely candidate to begin painting scenes from modern life. And that was for a very simple reason. He was absolutely intoxicated by and entranced by the art of the past, by the old masters. He spent many hours in the 1850s in the Louvre, both setting his easel up, as art students were taught to do at that time, in the corridors and rooms, and painted scenes from Tintoretto and so forth. And also he worked many hours in the Louvre's print room, signing out the engravings and making his own copies of them. One of these in particular intrigued him, and that was a design by Raphael, which was engraved by the most renowned engraver of the Italian Renaissance, a friend of Raphael, Marcantonio Raimondi. This dates from about 1515. It's called The Judgment of Paris. We see Paris here offering the golden apple to Thetis, the woman that he judges the most beautiful, thereby sets in train the events leading to the Trojan War. Manet, I think, was intrigued by the figures in the lower right-hand corner, one of which might look familiar to you, because if we had a mirror, if we could look at that backwards, it is Michelangelo's Adam from the creation of Adam in the vault of the Sistine Chapel, which Raphael, as I described in Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, had seen a couple of years earlier. So just imagine God the Father floating here, touching Adam's finger. The history of art is obviously an echo chamber or a hall of mirrors where painters are echoing and mirroring one another all the time, Raphael no less than anyone else. And so he was sort of paying tribute to Michelangelo at that point. Manet was intrigued by this painting, by this engraving, and I'll come back to that, the way that intrigue manifested itself shortly. Manet loved Italy and the art of Italy, and made at least three trips there in the 1850s. He went to Rome and made drawings of Raphael in the flesh, not merely the engravings in the Louvre print room. He went to Florence, and in the Uffizi, he made copies of this painting, which I'm sure many of you may know, not least because it's on the cover of Sarah Dunant's new novel, The Venus of Urbino by Titian, which still is, of course, in the Uffizi. Manet was fascinated by this painting, I think, for a number of reasons. It is a Venus, and Venuses or goddesses, and especially nude goddesses, were the most revered form of art in the middle of the 19th century in France, and I think Manet knew that he had to make his name with the female nude, as so many artists had done before him in the previous couple of decades. But I think he was intrigued by the ambiguity of it, as most people are, the fact that who exactly is this Venus, and why does she appear to have a daughter who's rummaging in a marriage chest, and with a servant standing by the side and a lapdog, which appears to be, or which was for in the Italian Renaissance, a symbol of marital fidelity. So there's the possibility that this Venus is really an aristocratic housewife lounging on her banquette in her palazzo. Of course, there's a third possibility, a possibility suggested by Mark Twain and among many others, after Twain saw it in the Uffizi, and that, of course, is that this woman is a courtesan. And Manet probably knew that the model for this painting was a famous Venetian courtesan. And so there was all of this mix in the painting that I think intrigued Manet and made him, therefore, make at least two copies of it when he was in Florence. When Manet finally returned to Paris, more or less for good, at the end of the 1850s, he did, however, begin to relinquish his interest in past art to some extent, and try to paint scenes of modern life. And I should point out that Manet was never a starving artist. He was never poor. He came from a very wealthy, almost aristocratic Parisian family. His mother was the goddaughter of the King of Sweden, a Napoleonic general, and his father was a wealthy magistrate whose family owned land in many parts of France. And Manet had a trust fund of 20,000 francs a year, which was as much as a first-class engineer would earn, the salary of an engineer, a top-flight government official, and he managed to spend his way through that every year. He was known at all of the fine tailors in Paris and in the most fashionable cafes and boulevards such as Tortoni, where he would hold court with people like Charles Baudelaire. He took full advantage, in other words, of this new urban environment that was growing up in Paris, the sort of Paris of Napoleon III, of Baron Haussmann, of the wide new boulevards that were being built in the 1850s and 1860s and transforming the cityscape of Paris. And finally, by the early 1860s, he decided to try to capture this new world in a painting. And according to legend, according to a friend of his, a fellow art student of his, and friend named Antonin Proust, an older distant relation of Marcel Proust, the writer, Antonin Proust, the two of them decided to go on a Sunday's outing to a place called Asnières, a few miles west of Paris on the Seine, to lounge on the riverbank, have a drink, have a picnic, and just people watch. And according to Proust, who was writing many years later, Manet surveyed the scene in front of him, people bathing in the river and having picnics, and said, "I'm going to do a nude for the next salon. It's going to be a modern scene. It's going to be exactly the sort of thing we see before us here I'll be ripped to shreds by the critics for it, but I don't care. Whereupon he brushed off his top hat, got to his feet, went to his studio, and began work on this painting, which I'm sure you recognize, Le Déjeuner sur l'herbe, the luncheon or picnic on the grass, or as Manet originally called it, Le Bain, the bath. We have the figure taking a bath in the background, and then one who evidently has taken one recently in the foreground. The Manet finished the painting in January of 1863, around the time, coincidentally, that Meissonier finished the campaign of France and was beginning work on Friedland. He submitted it to the Salon. I'm sure you know, at least in outline, what happened at the Salon. It was a juried exhibition through the 1850s. It was biennial. It became annual in the 1860s. It was a juried exhibition, so anyone could submit a work to it, but you had to get your work past the very formidable hurdle of a jury. And a consistent jury member, a stalwart on the jury in the 1860s, was, of course, Ernest Meissonier. And this painting was rejected in 1863 for the Salon. I think, unfortunately, I can't say very much about it tonight, but it's fascinating for all sorts of reasons, many of which were the things that led the jury to decline it. I'll just point out a couple of things. In the first place, this is the Judgment of Paris, so the scenes in the lower right-hand corner of the Raphael Marc-Antonio Raimondi Judgment of Paris. So we have sort of at two removes Michelangelo's reversed creation of Adam. But we also have a number of other things in the painting that make reference to art history, which I think would have been found sacrilegious or blasphemous, both for religious and artistic reasons. Unfortunately, you can't see this very well, and in fact, it's cropped from many reproductions of this image. But this orange blob you can see at the top is a finch. And the finch, as you may know, was a symbol of the Passion of Christ, for the simple reason that in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, it was believed that finches ate thorns, and in the sort of analogical medieval mind, that was good enough to make it a symbol of the Passion of Christ. And so, for example, you see many Madonna and Child paintings with a goldfinch somewhere in the painting as a sort of precursor, an image of a foreshadowing of what's going to happen. Likewise, however, they appear in Annunciation paintings, the paintings where the Virgin Mary is sitting, usually reading a book, and the Archangel Gabriel presents himself to her and is usually pointing and informs her of the Incarnation. And in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York right now, there's a Spinello Aretino painting on show of an Incarnation with a finch above it. And it may well have been that the, I've no evidence for this because no one seemed to say it at the time, but it may well have been the fact that these very pictorially literate judges, such as Meissonier, would have felt that this was Manet was being somewhat blasphemous by doing his own version of not only a Raphael image or a Michelangelo image, which would have been bad enough updating them in that way, but of an Annunciation painting in general. So, for example, we have the Archangel Gabriel in modern dress lounging on the grass in front of the nude Virgin Mary, who I think it's no accident that her clothing is blue, because as you probably know, the Virgin Mary was always, her gown was always blue. It was always ultramarine, the most beautiful and expensive of all of the pigments. So Manet seems to have been playing with that sort of almost blasphemous way of painting a picture. And so possibly given that, it's no surprise that the painting was rejected. You may know what happened after that, that so many paintings were rejected in 1863, more than 70% of all of those that were offered to the jury, that the artists began rebelling and agitating outside the windows of the Louvre and demanding that their works be shown. The Emperor Napoleon III, who was the nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte, decided that he couldn't suffer this situation any longer, and so essentially he said, let the people decide. Let all of these rejected works go on show with the other ones, and let's see if they're really as bad as the jury says they are. And Sure enough, the public decided when these works went on show in May of 1863 that they were indeed as bad as the jury said they were. And this painting in particular, along with James McNeill Whistler's The White Girl, these were the two paintings that were singled out as the most ridiculous in the Salon des Refusés, as it became known, the Salon of the Pariahs, Salon of the Heretics, as the press began calling it. Manet, however, nothing daunted by the very negative reception of this painting, then went to work on and then showed in 1865 in the Salon proper, not the alternative Salon, this particular work. Again, something that I'm sure that you are familiar with. This is Olympia. And if you think back to the painting in the Uffizi, the Venus of Urbino, Manet has once again updated a classic Italian Renaissance painting and given it a new twist. And in this case, he's completely evacuated all of the mythological trappings and the innocent trappings of the Venus of Urbino, and he's painted what is clearly and what was interpreted by all the critics and all of the people who came to see it in 1865, a prostitute. In probably one of the less salubrious areas of Paris. She's receiving a bouquet of flowers from an admirer who's probably on his way up the stairs as we speak. And unfortunately, you can't see it in this reproduction, but the lapdog that you remember from the Venus of Urbino has mutated into a black cat in this painting, and not just any black cat. It's a black cat with bright, shining eyes. It has an arched back and a tail that stands erect. And this was found particularly suggestive and salacious. And if we're to believe the stories in the press, and I think there's no reason why we shouldn't, people were actually physically afraid of this painting. They were so shocked by it. And women averted their gaze from it, and men, their husbands presumably, tried to protect their women's virtue by thrusting their walking sticks through it. And so ultimately they had to position guards in front of the painting to protect it. And then finally they had to raise it high on the wall in order to create order in the Salon of 1865 and also for the painting's own safety and preservation. The wages of Manet's new style, which I discuss, I don't have time tonight to talk about the particular way he painted, but obviously it's very, very different from the finishing style, the incredibly meticulous touch that Meissonier had. The wages of Manet's paintings really were 20 years of bad reviews, public mockery, and indifference among the connoisseurs. He didn't sell a painting for money until the age of 40. The only recompense he had for one of his works before the age of 40 was when he painted a friend of his, a man named Theodore Duret, who was the son of a cognac merchant. He painted Duret's portrait, and Duret gave him a crate of cognac as payment for it. He died in 1883, really without ever having had any great amount of lasting success at the Salon. In 1873, as I described, he had a modicum of success with a painting that, ironically enough, was could have almost been mistaken for a Meissonier painting. However, his legacy really isn't this sort of critical battering he took in those 20 years that he was showing paintings in the Salon or trying to. It was what happened from the mid-1860s on, when he began meeting with a number of other young painters in the Café Gerbois on the right bank near his studio. These men would come together and sort of form a support network, a group of painters who would complain about jurors like Meissonier and then go forth into their studios to try to create something that would be accepted or at least scandalize the next Salon. These men, of course, were people like Paul Cézanne, Claude Monet, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, if women had been allowed into cafes, they weren't allowed in, since it was said that if a woman dared venture into a Parisian cafe, she would be the subject of bold and rude conjecture. But Berthe Morisot was a member of this circle as well, and is known as the female impressionist. Anyway, all of them gathered together and saw Manet as their mentor. He was the inspiration for the sort of work that they began doing in the late 1860s and early 1870s. They, of course, suffered as much abuse and neglect as he did, but I'll just show you one of their paintings. This is a painting called Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe by Claude Monet, and it, I think, is a tribute to Edouard Manet, in that we have a figure lounging here. It's, it has the same title. It's an outdoor scene. And it is figures, crucially, in modern dress, which is what these young men decided that they were going to try to do. You probably know, again, in outline, what follows in 1874. These young men turn their backs on the salon system altogether because they've had so much difficulty having their works displayed there. And if they're lucky enough to get their works displayed there, they suffer critical maulings. Therefore, in 1873, a friend of Camille Pizarro, one of these young painters, wrote to Pizarro and said, if Meissonier is on the next jury, let's lead a boycott of the salon and let's not show our work there. And of course, Meissonier was elected to the jury the following year. And so true to their word, all of these painters boycotted the salon and held their own alternative exhibition. Again, a kind of salon de refusé, but one that they themselves organized. And that was, of course, the first Impressionist exhibition, which was held in the studio of a photographer, the man who took the pictures of both Manet and Meissonier that I've shown you, a man named Nadar. And they suffered the usual critical mauling once again, but at least formed a kind of group identity out of that. And they had seven more showings until 1888. What's interesting, though, is that Manet was not a part of any one of these eight Impressionist exhibitions. Despite the fact that he was their leader and mentor, he didn't want to display his paintings with them because he either didn't like the way they painted or he, in some cases, he didn't like them personally. That's particularly true of Paul Cézanne. He both did not like Cézanne's paintings. He said Cézanne is a bricklayer who paints with his trowel, but he also disliked him as a person. He found him very boorish and rude, uncouth, dirty, and which, to be fair to Manet, is what a lot of people thought about Cézanne. And also Pierre-Auguste Renoir. He didn't like Renoir's paintings. He said they look as though they were painted with cotton wool, which, again, is maybe not a bad description of Renoir's paintings. But he did like Renoir personally and took a kind of brotherly interest in his career. And at one point he took Claude Monet, who was also very good friends with Renoir, took him aside and said, look, you're his friend. Do him a favor and convince him to stop painting. You can see very well that it's not his profession. But I think fortunately for Renoir, this advice was not passed along or he chose to avoid it. Anyway, the crucial moment really for Manet and the Impressionists happened after Manet's death. He died in 1883 of complications of syphilis at the age of 51. 3 years after his death, the merchant of the Impressionists, a man named Paul Durand Ruel, was having so much trouble selling their paintings in France that he decided he would open an office in New York and try to sell to the Americans. Many of the Impressionists didn't believe that this would work, and in fact, Pierre-Auguste Renoir took a lot of convincing to have his paintings sent over on a ship. However, when in April of 1886, a show called The Impressionists of Paris opened at the National Academy of Design in New York, it won great favor, not only with the public, it was held over by popular demand, but also by the critics, who for the first time, the American critics this time, gave very favorable notices to the paintings, and also, even more crucially, the collectors and people, wealthy barons like the Havemeyers, began collecting Impressionist paintings. And Louisine Havemeyer bought 10 Manet paintings in the years that followed, and ultimately, of course, more than 100 Impressionist paintings, all of which were left to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And that really is the point then, the turning point for Manet and Impressionism, and also the turning point for the terminal point for Meissonier, because it was said that the Americans who collected painters like Meissonier and another of the great, the famous painters of the 1860s and 70s that I discuss in the book, a man named Alexandre Cabanel, tried to badmouth the Impressionists in America so that they wouldn't catch on. However, they did, as I've been describing, catch on, and that was really the end of the careers of Cabanel and Meissonier in America. And it got to the point where by the early part of the 20th century, you could buy a Meissonier painting for $825, which was less than 1/250th of what it would cost you, what it would have cost you a couple of decades earlier. And clearly, there are all sorts of reasons why Impressionism won favor in America and then in the 20th century, and why the sort of very representative figural style of Meissonier and Cabanel lost favor, and in fact has still been out of favor. I discuss many of these reasons in the book, but I think I'll conclude at this point, and we'll maybe take up issues like that if there are any questions about it. And if no more fire alarms go off. Thank you very much. I can stay here if I...
Well, certainly we have an opportunity to ask Mr. King questions. We have volunteers on each side of the aisle with microphones, and I see right there in the middle, the woman right there, and then the woman with the white jacket will go next, and then we'll continue.
Yes, what do you think it was about the American critics and public that is, you know, it saw something the French didn't?
I think the way Durand Ruhl tried to explain it to the Impressionists when he was convincing them to send their paintings was that they weren't dogmatic. One of the major impediments for the Impressionists was the fact that there was this rigid hierarchical structure of a kind of artistic establishment in Paris that resisted them because they defied all laws of painting. If you wanted to become a painter in France in the 19th century, you would, if all went well, get to study at the École des Beaux-Arts, which was the government-sponsored, the state art school. The professors there had all studied themselves at the École des Beaux-Arts and wanted you to paint like Raphael, who was if you asked all of them, if you asked 100 art critics, connoisseurs, and painters in the middle of the 19th century in France, who's the greatest painter of all time? 90 of them would have said Raphael. He was regarded as the greatest painter of all time. And the teaching structure at the École was to make you work like Raphael, to have historical scenes like Raphael painted, and also the same poses that Raphael painted. Many American artists obviously went to France and studied there and were part of the École system. However, I think when they came back to the United States, there wasn't the appetite for it. The American government, obviously one of the major purchasers of art in France was the French government, and it would only purchase things from people who were painting in this particular style, really the house style of the École. It was possible to come back to America and paint in a much looser style. And so what Durand Ruhl tried to explain, that there was not in America any sort of bias against a different type of art in the way that there was in France. And so it was almost, on one level, it was institutional. There wasn't that teaching structure. On the other hand, it possibly was just the fact that Americans were not interested in the heavily moralistic, patriotic images that the École des Beaux-Arts wanted the students to paint. And so, for example, scenes of groves of poplar trees or riverbanks or poppy fields or the boulevards of Paris were perfectly acceptable to Americans, and they didn't see these as any sort of a decline in art. Because in France, there was a hierarchy in painting. History painting was the highest, and landscape and still life were the lowest. But that hierarchy didn't really exist in America.
Okay. Yes, a question right here now.
I guess I'm sort of curious how you got from the Renaissance, you know, from ceilings and domes and chapels to this.
Good question. I've asked myself that a number of times. In one way, what I'm doing is looking at the end of the story that maybe begins with Brunelleschi's dome and Michelangelo and the Pope's ceiling, because in those books, I'm looking at the way a new artistic movement grows up out of various forces and with certain personalities. And that paradigm, that form of representation, holds sway for the next couple of centuries. And to the extent to which, as I was describing in my last answer, you could do nothing better in the eyes of critics in 19th century France than paint exactly the way Michelangelo or Raphael painted. And the major step away from that is taken by people like Manet and Cézanne. They break down that form of representation that began on the Italian peninsula in the 15th and 16th century. So that's maybe a slightly more abstract way of looking, justifying the sort of trajectory that I've taken from one art form to the other. Maybe the simpler way, though, and the much more pleasurable way for me was simply that I'm interested in certain moments in history where people come together, usually in cities as it happens, and a critical mass builds up. And I mean, for example, in Brunelleschi's Dome, I was intrigued at how in Florence, a city of 30 or 40,000 people in the 1410s, 1420s, 1430s, all of these people came together, like Brunelleschi, Donatello, Masaccio, and then within a decade or two of that, Leonardo and Michelangelo. And why was it that this could happen in a city like that? Likewise, why in Rome? Why did the High Renaissance begin in Rome early in the 16th century? And so I think if you're looking at art in those terms, the next big leap is Paris in the third quarter of the 19th century, because one thing I try to examine in The Judgment of Paris is why Paris was the venue for this new style of art. It could theoretically have happened any number of other places.
Okay. Yes, some more hands, please. The gentleman right there, and then you, sir, will go next.
I love your books. Do you paint?
No, I don't. Well, I used to when I was in high school, and my mother still has a painting that I did that my art teacher told me. It was a landscape with horses in the foreground and a sunset in the background and trees in the middle distance that my art teacher told me looked like sticks of broccoli, which was a very accurate description. My mother still has it on the wall of her house, and I always, every time I'm back, I beg her to take it down or at least efface my name from it. And I only take heart in the fact that she probably has it in the closet and then takes it out whenever I'm coming home and hangs it on the wall.
I'll be very quick. I'm shocked because I love your books. I've never read an art historian who understood the physical aspect of painting as well as you do. I do paint.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I have a debt to all sorts of art historians who do things. I just try to put it in a sort of entertaining fashion that, you know, we can all understand. I think if I can understand it, then everyone else can as well. Thank you.
Yes, sir, right here.
Do you think the development of photography caused art to grow further and further away from realism towards increasing amounts of non-realism?
Absolutely. I think that's a crucial development in the history of art, and it's not any coincidence that once photography begins to get established in really the middle of the 19th century and then the third quarter of the 19th century, that painting moves away from that sort of representation and into, as in the 20th century with Cubism, a kind of abstraction. The relationship, though, is actually quite a complex one between the two, because photography, just to set it, of course, begins in the late 1830s with the daguerreotype in 1837, I believe it is. And so at the period I'm writing, photography still is in its infancy. And painters were not threatened by it. Meissonier hated all inventions of the 19th century. I mean, he hated wrought iron and when the Eiffel Tower was being built in the late 1880s, he bombarded the French newspapers with letters complaining about this excrescence growing up on the Paris landscape. And you would think he would have hated photography, but he didn't. He had a photographic studio in his house, and artists, even representational artists like Meissonier, believed that they could use photography and the cliché, use photography to create better and better art. And the cliché in the 1850s and 60s about photography vis-a-vis a painting is that a photograph could only capture the surface. It could never show you the reality, the essence of it, which a portrait could. So, for example, if you had someone photograph you and you had someone paint you at the same time, the painting would always give a truer picture of you. However, I think that sort of denigration of photography begins to break down later in the 19th century to the extent to which, I think the relationship then changes and painters begin being influenced by photographic images, which is, I think, what you're thinking of. And with people like Edgar Degas, who is very interested in photography, and many of his paintings from the 1870s and 80s, where he crops figures out of his paintings, where he has almost extraneous figures moving through the background, look like bad holiday snapshots. And I'm sure that he was inspired by photography in that way. But you're absolutely right that what then happens in the decades that follow is artists begin to ask themselves, well, why should we begin doing, why should we spend 12 years like Meissonier trying to make something, capture something in every last single minuscule detail when a photographer can do it in 3 seconds?
Okay, some more questions. There, okay, well, I saw somebody pointing in a direction, but I didn't see I'm so sorry. Right there, okay.
Can you speculate why, in fact, there was this interest in retrospective art? It was happening at about the same time in England, wasn't it, with the Pre-Raphaelites?
Absolutely. Pre-Raphaelites versus the Impressionists is a very interesting comparison. They were, people like Dante Gabriel Rossetti and Holman Hunt were battling against a very conservative aesthetic establishment, which held many of the same views as the people at the École des Beaux-Arts. The Pre-Raphaelites were different from the Impressionists, though, in all sorts of ways, because their rebellion took a form. I mean, they didn't like Raphael's style of painting, but rather than coming forward from that and doing scenes of modern life, they went pre-Raphael, as the name suggests, and they went back to the Middle Ages. And I think you can compare someone like Dante Gabriel Rossetti's fascination with the poetry of Dante and the images of Italy in the Middle Ages or England in the Middle Ages, Arthurian legend, with Meissonier's intoxication with the past. In Rossetti's case, I mean, he was very clear that he hated all of the industrialization in Britain and he wanted to go back to a much simpler time. He ran into difficulty with the critics, not because his paintings were historical, but simply because the subject matter was judged as being almost obscene. I mean, these full-lipped, swooning maidens were, and also he led the sort of life of a reprobate, and he was seen as being morally reprehensible. I'm able to bring Rossetti into the judgment of Paris because he did come to Paris a number of times, and in the course of my book, in 1864, he came and was introduced by his friends Whistler and Fantin Latour to Edward Manet, and he went back to England and began writing to his friends and saying, there's a French idiot named Manet whose paintings are mere scrolls and fit for nothing but the decoration of lunatic asylums. And so you would think that Rossetti would have liked the painting. He said, all art in France at the moment is a beastly slop, and he had absolutely no truck with it. But despite all of that, it is an instructive comparison in a way, simply because they were fighting the same thing.
Okay. Right on the aisle.
When you were doing your research for the book, how much time, if any, did you actually need to spend in France?
Quite a bit of... It depends on what you mean by need, whether it was for my own personal satisfaction or... I use the Oxford University's Fine Arts Library, which is spectacular and has all sorts of journals and volumes and so forth. So I was able to do a lot of research there, but I needed to go to places like Poissy and see where Meissonier lived and also just, I mean, as when I was writing the books about Florence and Rome, I wanted to know relative distances and try. One thing I try to do in all three of these books is to recreate the atmosphere and the city as it was at that time. And I think you can read about a place so much and get an intellectual idea of it. But with, for example, Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling, I found out where Michelangelo's studio was when he was painting in the Sistine Chapel, and then I walked the distance from there to this door he would have gone into to begin his work, because I wanted to know how far it would have been, what he would have seen on the way, and sort of enter into his imagination in that way. And it doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the images on the Sistine Chapel, but I think it does tell us things about Michelangelo that are very interesting. And likewise, I wanted to see where Meissonier lived and worked and try to enter into the milieu that he occupied, and likewise with Manet in Paris. And as my accountant tells me, it's all tax deductible, so there's all sorts of reasons to do it.
Let's have one more question right here. The gentleman there.
Yes, the underlying theme that certainly informs this book of a group of outliers or outsiders challenging conventional wisdom seems to have enormous possibilities. What are you going to do next?
I'm not sure that this quite fits that paradigm, but what I'm doing right now, and as soon as I get home I have to start writing because I'm almost done the research, is a short biography in the Eminent Lives series that many of you might know, which is James Atlas Books and HarperCollins. I'm doing the Machiavelli for him, so I've gone back to 16th century Italy and actual physical battles, wars that are fought between Florence and the Empire and so forth. So I'll be finished that, or I have to be finished it if I'm going to meet my deadline, by early autumn. Thankfully, it's a much shorter book than The Judgment of Paris or Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling. After that, I'm not altogether sure. I'm sort of taking my own counsel and deciding what to do. I do actually have a contract to write a novel, a third novel, and I have a number of ideas for it as well, but I haven't ruled anything in or anything out right now.
Please join me in thanking Ruskin.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And we'll meet you upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.